Welcome to Drive Time GP, your trusted source for the latest healthcare news, specially designed for Australia's GPs. Interviews are available both online and through a private podcast. Don't forget, you can also claim CPD points for listening. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Beyond the surface, understanding and managing insomnia.
Insomnia is a highly prevalent condition in Australia. In fact, for six consecutive years, the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners Health of the Nation survey found sleep disturbance to be one of the top two most common presenting symptoms in general practice patients. Insomnia can be debilitating and often leads to a reduced quality of life. Successful treatment of insomnia not only improves sleep quality overnight, but can also subsequently improve the management of comorbid disorders, including depression. Despite the individual and societal burden from insomnia, studies have shown relatively few people still seek help for insomnia. Effective treatment of insomnia is complicated by two important considerations: the under-recognition and under-diagnosis of insomnia, and the heterogeneous treatment pathways available. Today we're speaking with Dr. David Cunnington. He's a sleep physician based on the Sunshine Coast, and we'll be speaking about insomnia management. Welcome to Drive Time GP, David.
Thanks, Brad.
So, David, most people are likely to suffer from the odd bad night's sleep at some point, but many people tend to use insomnia as an umbrella term to describe this bad sleep. Can you start off by telling us what's the actual medical definition of insomnia?
So there's a DSM-5 definition of insomnia, and that's characterised by difficulties with sleep occurring at least 3 nights a week for 3 months or more when circumstances and opportunities for sleep are ideal. And then there's an important additional part to that is that it's impacting on daytime functioning. Now, lots of us have sleep disturbance. Lots of us may have the sleep we sort of wish we had better sleep, longer sleep, maybe weren't awakening. But think of that as there's a lot of sleep dissatisfaction around with not being able to meet this idealized sleep of we all should get 8 hours and not wake up during the night, which really is an idealized norm rather than really what sleep is.
Can you tell us how prevalent the actual definition, the medical definition of insomnia is within the Australian population?
There's been a study done by the Sleep Health Foundation back in 2019 that showed that around 23% of the population would have met that diagnostic criteria for chronic insomnia. Now, acute insomnia, that's really common. Most of us will get a period of acute insomnia that's short-term, self-limited, at least once every year. But that chronic insomnia where people have still disturbed sleep despite everything else being stable, think of that as about 20% of the population.
I suppose a lot of people just think, if I've had insomnia last night, I'll feel a bit grumpy in the morning, and that's one of those short-term health outcomes. But can you take us through a few of the other short-term and the longer-term outcomes or impacts of insomnia that people experience?
Long-term insomnia has very significant consequences. There's associations with increased risk of hypertension, artery disease, heart failure, other cardiovascular morbidity and mortality, and altered glucose metabolism and diabetes. From a mental health point of view, there's a strong two-way relationship between insomnia and mental health, such as depression and anxiety, with disturbed sleep and insomnia increasing the risk of depression and anxiety, and likewise depression and anxiety increasing insomnia, which then feeds back to increased depression and anxiety. So chronic insomnia has consequences, and that's something we come back to because it's really important when we think about treatment options. Because often, particularly in primary care, we're very averse to risk when thinking about insomnia, but we've got to realise that insomnia itself comes with risk. So we can't have a sort of no-risk appetite when we think about managing it.
Well, certainly insomnia isn't a trivial condition, and sometimes in general practice I feel like every single patient has been telling me about their problems with insomnia. Can you talk us through the treatment options that are available to GPs for managing this condition?
So when we think about insomnia, really the first line therapy for chronic insomnia should be non-drug strategies like cognitive behaviour therapy for insomnia. Really good research showing that it's an effective strategy that helps to change the way people think and behave around sleep. And often changed thinking and behaviour has set up a self-perpetuating cycle of poor sleep over time. Unfortunately, though, cognitive behaviour therapy doesn't work for everybody. And even if people get a response to cognitive behaviour therapy, there's a significant proportion of people who will still have ongoing symptoms. So whilst cognitive behaviour therapy is a great starting point, one of the issues has been accessibility. There are limited practitioners available in Australia who have specific skills in cognitive behaviour therapy for insomnia. The Australasian Sleep Association and professional bodies have been very proactive in recent years of trying to upskill people, but there still is a skill deficit, so that's been an issue. But cognitive behaviour therapy for insomnia takes time, and it takes people putting in some effort, being motivated to change, and it's not something that's going to give an immediate result. And like a lot of psychological interventions, if people have high levels of distress, they often will need some pharmacotherapy to sit alongside that psychologically based therapy. Interestingly, when you look at what actually happens in primary care, there's good research in Australia showing that around 90% of people with insomnia are managed with pharmacotherapy. And common medications that are used and are approved for the treatment of insomnia include benzodiazepines, the benzodiazepine receptor agonists, the Z drugs, zopiclone and zolpidem, melatonin, the dual orexin receptor antagonist, or DORAs, and some other medications, including sedative antidepressants. Now, that research in Australia has shown benzodiazepines are the most widely used and prescribed medications, but as we know, they're not without their problems in terms of concerns about dependency, tolerance, and not necessarily replicating normal sleep architecture. The Z drugs also have good research showing short-term effectiveness, but their indication is for a four-week indication, and we also have some concerns over time about dependence and tolerance. Melatonin, available as Cicadin, as one of the brands in an extended-release formulation, is approved for the treatment of insomnia in people over the age of 55. One of the potential attractions of melatonin is a perception that it's better tolerated than some of the other medications, but there are issues with lack of data on long-term efficacy with medications like melatonin. The dual orexin receptor antagonists are a class of medication specifically designed to treat insomnia. They have a different mechanism of action from benzodiazepines and the Z drugs. Rather than working via a GABA-mediated mechanism to induce sleep, they work more via reducing the wakefulness drive. But really the key is recognising we have a range of tools available to manage insomnia, and it's trying to work with that individual person who's got insomnia to match the tools we use with what's going on. And it's also important to think of it in a multifaceted sort of way. For example, I saw someone earlier today who had insomnia, has been really done a lot of CBT, worked very hard on that for a number of years. But when you take a step back and look at what's driving insomnia, she actually had undiagnosed ADHD for many years. That's really the driver for her insomnia. So that needs to be managed in terms of managing things rather than just continually focusing on the CBTI and just an insomnia framework.
You previously mentioned the dual orexin receptor antagonists, or DORAs for short. Now, this class of medication has been around for nearly a decade in Australia, but they've got a very different action. They're a little bit more unique compared to other medications that have been on the market. Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
So think of orexin as a master neurotransmitter that's involved in promoting wakefulness. So if you have a medication that binds to the orexin receptor, so orexin receptor 1 and orexin receptor 2, and partially blocks those receptors, it'll reduce the activity of the orexin system. Now, that results in a reduction in wakefulness drive, hence a sleep effect. And that effect, unlike the effect mediated via the GABA mechanism, which is the more benzodiazepines and Z drug effects, is much more neutral on sleep architecture. So it doesn't appear to have the same impact on sleep architecture, and clinical trials with the dual orexin receptor antagonists have shown preservation of normal sleep architecture. It also doesn't work via a sedative mechanism, which is again that GABA mechanism, which is a very broad receptor or transmitter system right across the neurological system. And so people often feel a little different when they may take the DORAs compared to other medications, but that can also change their tolerability profile and potential for other side effects such as longer-term dependency.
So if you've got orexin that's waking you up and then we're using a blocker of that, you're essentially blocking your wakefulness neurotransmitter. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really nice way of thinking about it. And it is a totally different approach to how we've previously thought about sleeping medications, which are more about promoting the sleepiness drive.
And you mentioned that people sometimes feel a bit different using medications that are the dual orexin receptor antagonists. How do they feel different compared to other medications that they may have used previously?
Yeah, as I was talking about, medications that act via the GABA receptor, such as the benzodiazepines, often have that global CNS sedation effect. So people have that sense of just lack of awareness of things, the black curtains come down, time's passed, I know nothing of what happened, therefore it must have been good sleep. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it's good sleep, because in actual fact, normal sleep isn't that total unawareness of things. So with a dual orexin receptor antagonist, it's much more common for people to, and often early, undervalue their effect and say, well, I was still aware of things and therefore it probably didn't do anything. But in actual fact, in the clinical trials, when you look at the objective sleep data, sleep's improved to the similar magnitude to the other medications in clinical trials, but it doesn't feel that same unawareness of things. So I find that really helpful in clinical practices, just counselling people not to expect that sense of sedation or unawareness that may associate with other medications they've trialled.
There are two DORAs available, with Devigo or Lemborexant being the most recent. Now, can you give us an overview of the efficacy of Lemborexant for the treatment of insomnia?
So in multiple clinical trials, lemborexant's been shown to provide significant effect for reducing both time to get to sleep, so we call that sleep onset, and the amount of wakefulness, reducing the amount of wakefulness during sleep, so we call that sleep maintenance. Some of the clinical trials, for example, the Sunrise 2 was a 12-month study showing that the benefits continued out to 12 months. And although lemborexant is generally well tolerated, the most common adverse events to look out for are somnolence or sleepiness, headache, and abnormal dreams. In the clinical trials, there was no evidence of withdrawal or rebound insomnia following discontinuation of lemborexant. An important thing for me when I think about who I'm going to manage with medications as well is that in the key clinical trials for lemborexant, there are a number of older adults included in those trials, and they defined that as over the age of 65. In Sunrise 2, it was around a quarter of the study population were over the age of 65, showing good efficacy and were also well tolerated in that older population group as well, which is often a patient group where you're worried about drug interactions, you're worried about falls risk, you're worried about cognitive impairment, all things that were shown not to be a significant factor with lemborexant in those clinical trials.
Well, can you tell us where DORAs may play a role in clinical practice and who are the patients that would be suitable for DORAs and how do you start patients on them?
So when I'm managing someone with insomnia, I'm taking that sort of high-level look at what are going to be the potential contributing factors to insomnia and look at addressing those. I'm going to be looking at how they think and behave around sleep and trying to use cognitive behaviour therapy to recalibrate that and reduce those perpetuating factors. And then if there's still ongoing issues, and particularly if I suspect I'm going to need something to manage sleep over a long period of time, more than 4 weeks, that's really where I think the DORAs have a great role. Because of that clinical trial data for longer-term efficacy and their indication not being time-limited like the other medications, I'm much more comfortable being able to use the DORAs over a longer period of time. My own clinical practice, again, as a bit I've alluded to, people who are complex, maybe on multiple other medications or older with more comorbidities, is another group I'm much more comfortable with using the DORAs. Now, there are some contraindications. So because the DORAs work by suppressing orexin or partially antagonising the orexin receptor, people who have low levels of orexin, which is a condition narcolepsy with cataplexy, can get worsening symptoms of narcolepsy with orexin, dual orexin receptor antagonists. Like all medications, if we're using the DORAs, we should start at the lowest recommended dose. So for lemborexant is 5 milligrams. But if it's been well tolerated and you need greater effect, the dose can be increased to 10 milligrams.
Well, thank you so much, David, for talking about insomnia and the treatment options that are available. Can you summarise some of the key points for our GPs to take from this discussion today?
So as you've talked about, insomnia is really common, particularly in primary care. It's not without risk, so don't be dismissive of insomnia or don't think about, well, I'm only going to use a treatment that has no risk, because insomnia, chronic insomnia, has significant risk of both physical and mental health illnesses over time. The treatment guidelines rightly recommend that we use a mix of non-pharmacological, so psychologically based approaches and pharmacological approaches. So absolutely, I'll be proactive in using CBTI and looking locally where I can access that or whether I use an online module. And then if we're thinking about a sleep medication, trying to match that medication to the particular profile of the patient, but recognising that most medications aren't approved for use beyond 3 months and the benzodiazepines and Z drugs are only indicated for short-term use, so that if we are needing something that's going to be able to be used over a longer period of time, that's where the DORAs may have a role. And I think a key thing to finish on, Brad, is just to, from a general practice point of view, is if you've been managing it as insomnia and following the things we've talked about and it's not going to plan, the person's not responding, just take a step back and think, is it really insomnia? Is there something underpinning this? And the things that commonly fit that is other causes of hyperarousal, be that anxiety, perfectionistic thinking, obsessional thinking, trauma, neurodiversity. Because a lot of the time I'll be seeing people referred to me in specialist practice where the GP's done all the right things and they haven't responded. And when I take a step back, there's that underlying predisposing factor that's the clue.
Well, thank you so much for taking us through all of these topics on Drive Time GP. Dr. David Cunnington from the Sunshine Coast, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Brett.
This interview forms part one of a two-part series on the management of insomnia. Next time, we'll be diving deep into more patient profiles and looking at what treatment options are the most appropriate for your patients.
Please note, Dovigo, lemborexant, is a prescription medicine not PBS listed in Australia and is unfunded in New Zealand. Before prescribing Dovigo, please review the full product information for information on dosage, contraindications, precautions, interactions, and adverse effects available in Australia at either www.asahi.com.au/PI or the Drive Time Radio website, or in New Zealand at www.medsafe.govt.nz. Dovigo is included in the Black Triangle Scheme, as it is subject to additional monitoring in Australia. This will allow quick identification of new safety information. Australian healthcare professionals are asked to report any suspected adverse events at www.tga.gov.au/reporting-problems. Substantiating references can be obtained on the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Asahi Australia Proprietary Limited, South Bank, Victoria, and produced in May 2025. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Understanding and managing tension-type headaches. A practical approach for GPs.
Headaches are common, and tension type headache is the most common headache in the general population. Now, given the prevalence of headaches in the population and the frequency with which we GPs see patients with headaches, of course, it's important that we have got a really good understanding of the different headache types and their management. Simple analgesic agents like paracetamol, aspirin, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can be given as initial therapy for tension-type headache, but care needs to be taken when we're using these medications because of the risk of medication overuse headache. It's all pretty complicated. So what else can patients try when their symptoms persist? We're going to sort this out today. And with me in the studio in Sydney is our fellow GP, Dr. Eugene Koo, and in the Gold Coast, physiotherapist Ian Harris and pharmacist Joyce McSwan. And we're going to talk all about the diagnosis and management of tension type headache. Guys, welcome to Drive Time GP.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you.
Eugene, let's start with you. Tension type headaches, they're really common. Can you tell us about exactly how prevalent they are and the impacts that they have on the lives of our patients?
Well, tension type headaches are extremely common, as you've said, and they can impact our patients severely, depending on the type of headaches they have. for those who are lucky enough to get it infrequently, they get it less than one day per month. And that's about 63.5% of tension type headache patients. Those who get it frequently, which is 1 to 14 days per month, this accounts for 21.6% of tension type headache patients. That's significant because up to 14 days, that's half the month. And those who get it chronically, they can get it for 15 more days a month, as we can both agree these people are suffering, but that's about 1% of the tension type headache patients. Nonetheless, we found that with these sort of headaches, on average, there can be up to 9 lost workdays and 5 reduced effective days per year. And this is just counting the economic loss for not turning up to work. We haven't counted for the personal impact on patients' lives, the disability it causes to them, the impact on relationships, family and friends. A recent Danish study told us that the number of workdays lost due to tension-type headaches was 820 compared to 270 per 1,000 individuals for migraines per year, telling us that there's a greater burden of tension-type headaches that takes its toll on the population. Very common, people are suffering.
Yeah, that's just incredible. Ian, let's turn to you. How does tension-type headaches usually present? And can you tell us a little bit about how we diagnose it? Because it can be really tough, right?
Absolutely. It's very, very tough to diagnose. Tension-type headaches usually present as a constant, dull, pressing, band-like pain, and it's typically bilateral. The pain is mild to moderate in intensity and lacks the pulsating, throbbing quality of particularly migraines. Tension-type headaches are generally non-disabling, meaning patients can often continue with their daily activities despite their headaches, so activity doesn't really particularly affect it. Many patients also report associated muscle tenderness, and this is often in the jaw, the scalp, the neck, and the shoulder regions, which contributes to the discomfort as well. One of the things we find really important because of the lack of specific diagnostic tests is taking a very thorough history to elicit the type of headache that we might be dealing with. The history, how long has the patient experienced these headaches, the frequency and duration, the nature of the pain, whether it's dull, pressing, or band-like, with any visual symptoms, that's very, very important, such as blurriness. With the presence of nausea and vomiting, which is typically absent in a tension headache. Sensitivity to light or sound, which can be occasionally be present. But in a tension headache, it's very, very mild, and it's definitely not the primary feature. It's unlikely to have more than one of these symptoms, and they'd be very mild. Known or suspected triggers such as stress, prolonged poor posture or muscle tension is often there for tension headaches, which is a little bit different in migraines particularly. It's also crucial to rule out any identifying red flags such as sudden onset of severe headache, often a thunderclap headache, new headache in patients over 50, headache with neurological symptoms such as weakness, visual changes or confusions, and worsening headache with a cough or straining, and headaches accompanied by a fever or systemic illness. So you can see how the history taken is of utmost importance in a tension-type headache to rule out others, as well as to confirm a diagnosis of a tension headache.
So there are a lot of crossovers when it comes to migraine and tension-type headaches. Have you got some good tips for us GPs on how to actually distinguish between them? And is that an important thing to do? Like, do we need to actually tell the difference between them?
Absolutely. It's vital to be able to tell the difference because it will guide our treatment of the particular headache. Bear in mind, there can be slightly mixed headaches, but there are definitely some tips to highlighting that it might be more likely to be a tension-type headache. Migraines typically involve the autonomic nervous system, so the photophobia, phonophobia, and osmophobia are very, very common. Important migraines usually don't last much longer than 3 days, and tension headaches can persist for much longer. A milder, described as constant band-like pressure that is usually bilateral. It does not worsen with physical activity. And the triggers generally are more related to food and hormone changes, sensory stimuli in migraines, whereas in tension headaches, they're more commonly triggered by stress, muscle tension, and prolonged poor postures, as seen with desk and computer work, prolonged positions. These differences can help us with diagnosis and both the management. So that'd be very, very important.
Eugene, let's come back to you. Have you got advice for your fellow GPs about managing tension-type headaches?
It's very important we give our patients clear and simple instructions. And firstly, they should be encouraged to self-manage their tension-type headaches. This would mean self-monitoring of symptoms, identifying triggers, such as posture, prolonged desk use, and also adapting their lifestyles to avoid making their symptoms worse. It's very important that they maintain good sleep hygiene, you know, stop the phones by 6 p.m., no blue light, and, you know, get to sleep, exercise regularly. This would keep the muscles happy. Maintain good hydration, eating regularly. Relaxation and stress management techniques are very important just to let the muscles around the head, neck and shoulders and back relax as well. It even helps if they do mindfulness meditation or diaphragmatic breathing. And of course, they should avoid situations that can lead to musculoskeletal pain in the neck, shoulders and even around the back that can trigger these headaches. So good computer workstation ergonomics, very important. They should take regular breaks from computer screens. Every 30 minutes of sitting, you should just get up and stretch for a minute. Keep a close eye on caffeine because that can be a trigger. When in doubt, they should also see a physio. And physiotherapists are very helpful with musculoskeletal troubleshooting and providing treatment for tension-type headaches.
Fantastic advice. I take absolutely none of it in my daily life, I have to tell you. Joyce, let's bring you in here. What about when we do all of the things that Eugene's just suggested and the symptoms just keep going on? Often our patients do want a pharmacological solution. What do you suggest?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there is a place for non-pharmacological treatment, but sometimes the intensity really requires some pharmacological help. So typically I would suggest, given the pathology, that there is focus on using pharmacological treatments that relax the musculature. Now, typically we know we use paracetamol, aspirin, non-steroidals as the initial therapy for tension type headache. And that's certainly reasonable. However, there is a chance of overuse with these pharmacological agents. However, the problem is that if we use it for more days of the month, 15 or more, we really start to get into trouble. So we really need to limit treatment days to only about 9 days per month if possible. But when you hear some of the things that my colleagues are talking about in terms of frequency, sometimes it's not that possible. The other thing to really avoid and to be aware of with pharmacological treatments are opioids, benzodiazepines, and any of the ones that deal with cognitive dampening, as it were, really should be avoided. I know they're easy to kind of gravitate to because traditionally we think them as strong pain relievers, but they really will worsen the headache in the longer term.
Can we talk about orphenadrine, which is a muscle relaxant? It does have a role for tension type headaches, but a lot of GPs don't necessarily turn to it as our first line. How does it work and what's its place in managing tension type headaches?
Absolutely. It's a molecule that we forget. And typically when you treat anything, you want to treat some kind of causation in terms of being aligned with the pathology. So again, we heard from our colleagues here that there's certainly musculature involved. And while we deal with inflammation, which is secondary to the muscle tension, we should treat the muscle tension with something that's a relaxant. And with this molecule, what it does is it actually relaxes the skeletal muscles. And how it does that is that it blocks the muscarinic acetylcholine receptors, and it actually does help with some of that nerve impulsing. Interspinal cord relaxes the muscles, and it also has, interestingly, an antagonistic effect on histaminergic receptors. Now, with the histaminergic receptors and even crossing over to some of the serotonergic receptors, it actually has some contribution around, actually helps to relax the spasm, the muscle spasm. And that's why I think Ian was talking about the band, you know, that tight band. So in Australia, in orphenadrine, we've got products like Norflex, which is 100 milligrams orphenadrine. And then we've got Norgesic, which is in combination. It's a lower dose and it's combined with paracetamol, 450 milligrams. So it's a very versatile formulation.
Let's talk about adverse effects of orphenadrine.
In terms of side effects, you can get drowsiness, you can get dry mouth, and also some of the anticholinergic effects there as well. Some patients do develop tachycardia or palpitations, urinary hesitancy, like that of anticholinergic agents. You know, we've got to be careful with those with glaucoma as well. And so some patients, you know, do get blurred visions or dilation of pupils, even increase in ocular tension. So contraindicated in those with glaucoma, of course. Your stock standard sort of vomiting, dizziness, even headaches. You've got to be cautious with that. So typically I tell my patients, look, start with a low dose. A formulation like Norgesic in combination with paracetamol already in there is quite synergistic. And I tell my patients, look, start with a low dose. Let's see how you go. If you're concerned, have it at night and then monitor. And if my patients can adopt and adapt well, then I will not hesitate to help them to increase the dose judiciously.
It's been a really great talk about tension type headaches, something that every GP would see at least once a week. What I'm hoping is that we can get each of you to give your key take-home messages that you want GPs to hear from listening to Drive Time today. Eugene, let's start with you.
Well, for GPs, it's very important they listen to their patients. And considering that opioids and benzos can turn up positive on pre-employment medicals and drug tests, orphenadrine can be a viable option. But we have to be careful because for some people, they experience sedation when on orphenadrine, so that's something we must take into account. Otherwise, it's definitely worth a shot.
Sounds like a great tip. Ian, what's your top tip for GPs?
Get the diagnosis right. Really listen to the patient from the diagnostic criteria. Differentiate between particular common ones, the migraines and the tension headaches. Once you've got that right, get the treatment right, get appropriate activity, get change of positions, manage stress, and find enjoyment in particularly work and life balance, I think is really, really important with these tension headaches.
I love that advice. Joyce, your final words.
I think it's very important during a plan that the patient knows when to take the orphenadrine and paracetamol. So as a GP, giving them some quick guidance around that, take it early, take it when you feel that muscle tensioning. Patients can be a little bit tentative given the anxieties with taking medicines that are new. Some will save it to the last intense pain option, and that's not really going to work then very well. But all of that is really proactive.
Great tips. I love that. Dr. Eugene Koo, Ian Harris and Joyce McSwan, thank you so much for joining us on Drive Time GP.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Please note the PBS information for Norgesic, orphenadrine and paracetamol is not listed on the PBS. Before prescribing, please review the full product information. The substantiating references and product information can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by iNova Pharmaceuticals and produced in March 2025. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Hot Flushes, a journey through vasomotor symptoms mini-series. Part 4, Putting It Into Practice. Which menopause patients may consider non-hormonal treatment?
Hormone therapy with estrogen alone or a combination of estrogen and progesterone has been found to be the most effective treatment for vasomotor symptoms, VMS, of menopause. However, menopausal hormone therapy, MHT, is not appropriate for every woman due to underlying medical conditions or risk factors, or indeed a preference not to take hormones. Despite the significant disruption that menopause symptoms cause to their lives, only 10% of those with bothersome symptoms use MHT. For the 90% who cannot or choose not to take hormones due to medical conditions or preferences, well-tolerated and effective non-hormonal therapy for the relief of VMS is crucial. In this fourth episode of our VMS series, Ginny Mansberg shares her insight about particular groups of women who may benefit from exploring non-hormonal alternatives to MHT in treating VMS. Welcome, Ginny. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
So, Ginny, let's start with women who are actually contraindicated to MHT. There's common misconception out there among practitioners that there are perhaps more contraindications than there actually are. For example, let's take the example of Sarah. Sarah's struggling with night sweats, increasingly frequent hot flushes that are making her uncomfortable at work. She actually had a VTE when she was younger. So some practitioners think she's not a candidate for MHT. Can you remind us of the actual contraindications for MHT and approximately how many women are contraindicated?
Very few, including Sarah. So I would say that Sarah, if she had an unprovoked VTE when she was younger, that might be a little bit of a cause for concern. But if she had been on a plane and she'd been on the contraceptive pill, for example, we would not consider that a contraindication to MHT. So let me just go through it. If you look at the Australasian Menopause Society's menopause toolkit, they've got a few, and it's a current VTE. You have one at the moment. You have an estrogen-dependent breast cancer, you have severe liver disease, not the deranged LFTs that we see with somebody with a fatty liver. You have undiagnosed vaginal bleeding, we do need to rule out endometrial cancer, or uncontrolled vascular disease. That's not somebody who's got well-controlled hypertension, that is uncontrolled vascular disease. And I would say that a first unprovoked VTE is definitely not a contraindication. We do know that patients who have a migraine with aura, those unprovoked VTEs, we don't like them having oral estrogen because of that first pass metabolism in the liver. There are a number of prothrombotic metabolites, and so they can be offered transdermal estrogen. No problem, it doesn't increase our vascular risk or risk of thrombotic events. Hormone-sensitive cancers, obviously, it's a really big concern. But having a breast cancer risk, for example, you know, my grandmother had breast cancer, my sister had breast cancer, is not a contraindication. I think we do need to acknowledge that combination estrogen and progestin, MHT, does confer a slightly increased risk long-term of breast cancer, particularly with longer use. So, in other words, there are very few women who do have an absolute contraindication to MHT.
So, Ginny, we've just heard from you that there aren't that many women in whom MHT is contraindicated. But in those where it is contraindicated, would you consider using the non-hormonal therapy fezolinetant, which actually has been available in Australia since April 2024? What's your experience of using it in that group of women?
Oh, it's been really good, actually. I think we have had a number of off-label medications, but the advent of a specific medication for the vasomotor symptoms that are related to menopause has been a bit of a game changer. So what you'll see is at least you can offer women a choice, which is really important. They need to know what all of their options are, and then they can choose to take fezolinetant. It is a single daily dose. It is quite convenient. It has really very few side effects. So it has a lot to offer. And I think having that in our armamentarium of things to offer to women has been really incredible for me as a practitioner.
And just share your experience, Ginny, in prescribing fezolinetant.
In the trials that patients were seeing benefits within a week, my patients often describe within 2 days cessation of their vasomotor symptoms. And because the side effect profile is so well tolerated and because it's so convenient just to take a single tablet every single day, the satisfaction is high and the patients ceasing and, you know, not coming back for a script, I think is sitting at zero in my patient cohort. So I'm finding enormous success from it, and I'm very excited to see other patients use this, other women being offered this treatment and seeing if it can make a huge contribution.
Ginny, what about the patients who are nervous or hesitant? So let's take Mia, for example. She's worried about drawing attention at work because of her frequent sweating episodes. She's really exhausted due to the night sweats interrupting her sleep, and she feels like she's unable to take care of her family. She's really hesitant to take MHT because of her family's history of breast cancer. So that can be quite a common situation. Can you tell us about other conditions where we might need to take caution and probably touch on that family history as well?
I think you must have been sitting in my surgery for the past few months. I see patients like Mia all the time, and there is concern about the link between menopause hormone therapy and breast cancer. And it's really a hangover from the Women's Health Initiative. When a patient has a concern, my coming in over the top of them and going, no, you've got nothing to worry about, I don't want to listen to you, you're just being silly, is not the way to engender trust, and it's not the way to actually get the optimum outcomes for the patient. So we need to really validate her concerns. And we do need to acknowledge that there is an increased risk of breast cancer from long-term use of MHT. So what we want to do is to validate those concerns and then come to her with a range of options that she can choose to take in order to alleviate what are some really nasty symptoms. I mean, this woman is being affected at work. It's affecting her family life. It's affecting her ability to sleep. We know over time that will raise issues around mental health. So we want to make sure that we have an evidence-based range of options to present her with so that she can make a really good choice for her life going forward.
There are some patients also, Ginny, with the best will in the world, they're just intolerant to that MHT. So let's look at Emily. She's been taking MHT and found it really effective in reducing VMS, but she's actually had to stop it due to severe headaches. She's really upset about the return of her VMS symptoms and the significant impact it's having both on her work and her personal life. So would fezolinetant be an option here?
Oh, absolutely. And again, we need to listen to her, validate the concerns she brings. Not everything is in the textbook. So I find a lot of intolerance to progesterone with a lot of anxiety and or depression. Progesterone's not always that well tolerated. There is often breakthrough bleeding, unscheduled bleeding and breast tenderness, particularly in the early stages. So it's really good to counsel women before you start them on MHT to say you might encounter this for the first few months. Headache is not uncommon. Nausea is not uncommon. There are people also for whom MHT does not work to reduce their symptoms, particularly women who are larger. Obesity does seem to really clip the wings of MHT's ability to really help women. In that group of women for whom vasomotor symptoms are their biggest concern, we do have other options for them. And that is the really great news. Increasingly, with the advent of fezolinetant being available in Australia, that is something that I'm suggesting as the first choice in a buffet of options for my patients. And many of them find really significant relief. I think we do need to acknowledge that menopause is not just about hot flushes. There are many other symptoms as well. Having said all of which, Sneha, I've been really fascinated that so many of my patients have come back in, and once their vasomotor symptoms are completely alleviated and they're now sleeping, they are not wanting to drink as much. They are not yelling at their kids as much. Their mood is improving. Now, I would not attribute that at all to the fezolinetant, but I am attributing that to the fact that vasomotor symptoms are awful and they really take a huge toll on women's lives. And if we can get rid of them, it's amazing how many dominoes fall that have also been barriers to her having a meaningful midlife.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's all about quality of life when we're managing menopause. So there are women who may be eligible to take MHT, but just don't want to take hormones, you know, no matter how bad their symptoms are. So for example, let's take Jane. She's been experiencing night sweats that frequently disrupt her sleep and make it really difficult for her to stay focused at work. She's also frustrated at how frequently the hot flushes are interfering with her everyday activities. She's researched treatment options for VMS and she's not willing to take or even consider hormone therapy. How common is this still in your practice and how might you approach it?
I think we need to be respectful of our patients' choices, and unless they're doing something frankly dangerous for themselves, we need to be really careful that we don't appear to be judgmental or harsh. But with those people, we can say we have a range of options for you, one of which is treating it with medication. Listen, out of the 75 to 80% of women who do report getting vasomotor symptoms, only one in three of them reports them being moderate to severe. There are women who have vasomotor symptoms that are not severe and they might choose not to take anything. That's a totally reasonable decision to make. Our role as clinicians is just to assist our patients, to inform them about the things that are out there and the benefits and the risks of the things that are out there, and to help them make a decision for themselves about their bodies. And fezolinetant would be a really good option for someone like Jane. I think you can be a little bit of a frog in a pot and not get how bad things are when you are having hot flush after hot flush. You haven't slept through the night in years. You will start to get really snappy. That's just what happens. And it can be amazing how alleviating those vasomotor symptoms can just change everything. And they hadn't even realised how bad things were.
Ginny, thanks so much for talking about the types of patients who might want to consider a non-hormonal treatment such as fezolinetant. Could you just summarise the key messages that you want the GPs listening to this episode to take away from today's discussion?
So I think we need to acknowledge that severe vasomotor symptoms are really distressing for women. And as clinicians, we need to listen to their stories, validate what they're experiencing, and then offer them a range of evidence-based treatments, talk about the pros and the cons, and make sure that we are tailoring our treatment options for their individual needs, their life circumstances, their medical history, and their tolerance of various side effects. We know that fezolinetant, which is neurokinin-3 receptor antagonist, is reasonably effective at reducing vasomotor symptoms with a very good tolerability and side effect profile, which is quite reassuring. I think, Snay, what we can really say is women's health has just taken this enormous leap forward recently. And I think the idea around women's empowerment and shared decision making is a really big part of that. And I think also having more evidence-based treatments like fezolinetant that is specifically formulated for the vasomotor symptoms of the menopause is a huge leap forward for us as clinicians, as having an extra tool to offer women and also for women themselves.
Ginny, thank you so much. You've been insightful and sharing your wisdom as ever. So it's been great today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please note the following PBS information for Veozah, fezolinetant. This product is not listed on the PBS. Before prescribing, please review the Veozah product information. Product information is available from Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited by calling 1800 751 755 or accessible online via the TGA website or www.astellas.com/au/products. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited and produced in April 2025. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Dietary challenges in Type 2 Diabetes miniseries. Part 4, Updated Diabetes Handbook. Where do diabetes-specific nutritional formulas fit in?
The landscape of type 2 diabetes treatment has evolved dramatically in recent years, with advances in research, medicines, and technologies. To align with these changes, the RACGP has launched a refreshed version of the Management of Type 2 Diabetes, a handbook for general practice, which is often referred to as the Diabetes Handbook, and provides GPs with the latest evidence and guidance for managing people with type 2 diabetes. Joining us today is Dr. Gary Deed, a dedicated specialist GP and chair of the RACGP Diabetes Specific Interests Committee. Gary will refer to the key changes in the handbook with a focus on inclusion of diabetes-specific nutritional formulas, DSNFs. He will also share practical tips on integrating DSNFs into general practice. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
So, Gary, effective management of type 2 diabetes really hinges on the crucial role of general practice. The RACGP Diabetes Handbook is a vital source for GPs, and it's just undergone its first update in 4 years. Can you give us the top lines on the main additions and changes to this new edition?
This November 2024 edition represents the ongoing collaboration between the RACGP and Diabetes Australia. And there's some really good new updates that have been included, including the remission of type 2 diabetes, weight management, sleep and disability, cognitive decline, dementia and hearing impairment, plus also updates in some of the sections that were there before, such as early onset diabetes, newer therapeutic agents to use, mental health complications, and also the use of technology in managing type 2 diabetes. But importantly, we've included in a new section under lifestyle interventions in the management of people with type 2 diabetes that includes these diabetes-specific nutritional formulas.
So, Gary, you mentioned the handbook now includes diabetes-specific nutritional formulas. That's the DSNFs. Can you remind us what they are?
I think this is very important for GPs like ourselves to understand that these diabetes-specific nutritional formulas are very specialized nutrition formulated to assist people with diabetes or impaired glucose tolerance. They have low glycemic index and complement other dietary recommendations that support people with type 2 diabetes by containing proteins, vitamins, minerals, and also monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fatty acids that helps improve blood glucose levels, hemoglobin A1C, glycemic variability, nutrition adequacy, and other health benefits.
And what are the differences between DSNFs and very low energy diets?
Now, distinctly, the VLEDs are designed for the management of obesity. They're recommended for people who have a BMI greater than 30. They have a composition that's very low in calories and also being low in carbohydrates and fat, but is high in protein. So they're designed to promote ketosis, used as a total meal or total diet replacement. Diabetes-specific nutritional formulas can be used independent of BMI. If you are overweight, DSNFs can be used to replace a meal, such as breakfast or a snack, or if a person's underweight, it can be used to supplement between meals. So they're not to be used as a total meal or total diet replacement. They're there to complement a healthy whole food dietary approach.
So Gary, what's the evidence behind the DSNFs and why have they been included in the handbook?
Well, to really punch through that space, there was a consensus expert working group of multiple practitioners across people from the Australian Diabetes Educators Association, the Australian Diabetes Society, the Dietitians Association of Australia, and also the RACGP. And a consensus statement was developed just prior to the release of our handbook for the management of type 2 diabetes. And that contained current evidence that suggests that the nutritional management of type 2 diabetes can be improved with the use of these formulas. And there are clinical studies that underpin their use as an alternative way to support people with diabetes in optimizing nutritional intake, improving glycemic management, and overall health outcomes when whole food options are not feasible.
So does this mean that DSNFs can also be used with diabetic patients who might be getting hypoglycemic episodes as well?
I think you've picked out a very important clinical use of these DSNFs in that you can utilise that in people who are at risk of hypoglycemia, especially at nighttime, for instance, such as the elderly or people taking sulfonylureas and insulin, and they can be used to supplement an evening meal by a later snack because many people actually eat early and they don't realise an extended period of lack of carbohydrates can lead to nocturnal or nighttime hypoglycemia. So they're utilised in that instance, definitely.
So there are clear benefits for DSNFs. Can you now take us through who's the ideal patient for these supplements and what does the Diabetes Handbook recommend in this space?
It's important to understand that they have a role, as I said, a supplement to a whole food approach. But think about in your own clinical work, people who need support post-operatively and they're not eating well, it's really useful to supplement and to recommend these DSNFs. Multiple people now using GLP-1 receptor agonists for weight management, where there's a reduction in what they're eating, and DSNFs are used to supplement and maintain a glycemically balanced nutritional approach. Also, with metabolic surgery, there's certainly evidence that these may be utilised in that space as well.
So you mentioned the GLP-1 receptor agonists, and these are increasingly prescribed in people with type 2 diabetes. And a matter of growing concern in that is the loss of skeletal muscle mass and function as a result that can accompany that rapid and substantial weight reduction. Can we just talk through the role for DSNFs in supporting patients who are using GLP-1 receptor agonists and have experienced that significant weight loss?
I think we've opened up a very important avenue that needs to be addressed by GPs supporting patients with the GLP-1 receptor agonists, is that 10% or more muscle mass is lost as well as fat loss. So maintenance of muscle mass is very important when we're doing calorie-restricted weight reduction. And addressing nutrition as well as physical activity should be a balanced approach to that problem. Nutritional therapy should ensure that we've got adequate intake of high-quality protein and micronutrients. When prescribing GLP-1 receptor agonists, always consider whether you want to add a DSNF to your patient to fill nutritional gaps to, as I said, address muscle loss and nutritional deficiencies. In fact, a study in patients with type 2 diabetes showed that those using DSNFs had a significant increase in percent lean muscle mass and reductions in fat mass, adipose tissue around the visceral area of the body, waist circumference, compared to those that didn't utilise them. So it says that these DSNFs help promote targeted reduction in weight, positive redistribution of body fat, but preserving lean muscle mass, which is important for many health outcomes, including insulin resistance.
So what about the role of the DSNFs in patients with an HbA1c that is consistently slightly elevated, so 7.5, despite our concerted attempts to lower it, or in fact the patients who are overwhelmed with a new diabetes diagnosis? You know, these patients may not warrant starting a diabetes medication with concern of potential adverse effects. So can we use DSNFs in this space?
I think this is a common clinical phenomenon in early diabetes, and there's a lot for patients to digest, both intellectually, let alone physically. And so consider the use of DSNFs in replacing a breakfast meal is one simple change which may actually reduce your hemoglobin A1C without adding to medication burden and also, you know, offsetting the risk of potential side effects. And it's shown that low-calorie diet utilising these DSNFs at about 6 months that their patients were found to have a hemoglobin A1C reduction of 1.1% and a reduction of the need for step-up to oral hypoglycemic therapies compared to those who didn't use them where there was an increase in the need of oral hypoglycemic agents. So here's a practical example, a meal replacement at breakfast time for those people right early in the start of their diabetes journey where we can help support them. But also, there are people who have got impaired glucose tolerance, as we call it, pre-diabetes, where these also can be utilised in a lifestyle plan, including diet and physical activity. Myo-inositol, which is added to some DSNFs, which helps improve insulin resistance in metabolic syndromes, type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, and polycystic ovarian syndrome.
So lastly, with the current cost of living pressures, what's the price point for these DSNFs?
I think this is surprising to people that these products can be purchased over the counter at pharmacies and cost $2.50 per serve. They're also available in liquid and powder form, so it can be individualised to the patient and not hit that hip pocket that we all should be aware of.
Thanks, Gary, for taking us through the key changes in the RACGP Diabetes Handbook, particularly pertaining to the DSNFs. Can you summarise the key take-home messages for our GPs today?
Important, go and look on the RACGP website and look at the latest type 2 diabetes handbook with those significant updates across a range of conditions. I think that would be helpful. Also, understand and include the use of these diabetes-specific nutrient formulas as part of your evidence-based management of people with diabetes or impaired glucose tolerance. In that, we're trying to support glycemia, weight management, nutrient intake in situations where a whole food intake is challenging in the management. There's so many of those patients. Think of those patient groups such as post-operative nutritional support, people using a GLP-1 receptor agonist for weight management after metabolic surgery. And the last message is always consider using an accredited practicing dietitian to support your nutritional approaches for your patients.
Thanks for joining us, Gary. That has been a marvellous overview of the role of DSNFs in type 2 diabetes and beyond. Thank you.
That's okay. Stay healthy.
Brought to you by Glucerna, a clinically proven diabetes nutritional supplement backed by 30 years of scientific evidence, proven to perform. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Abbott Nutrition and produced in April 2025. The Baker Type 2 Diabetes and Heart Failure Miniseries, Part 7. Type 2 Diabetes. Identifying cardiovascular risk is a critical aspect of clinical care.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane. The mortality rate in people with type 2 diabetes almost doubles with the coexistence of cardiovascular disease. Typically, people with type 2 diabetes experience cardiovascular disease earlier and with greater severity. Risk assessment, therefore, remains fundamental to the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease to allow early risk factor modification and to target pharmacotherapy to those who will benefit the most. Given that majority of type 2 diabetes management occurs in primary care, it's vital that GPs regularly assess cardiovascular risk in patients with type 2 diabetes to improve outcomes. Today, we explore how GPs can efficiently incorporate CVD risk assessment for type 2 diabetes patients, both opportunistically and into scheduled health assessments. We have with us today Professor Jonathan Shaw, Deputy Director, Clinical and Population Health from the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in Melbourne, who will provide valuable insights into a holistic approach for the management of type 2 diabetes patients who are at high risk for CVD. Welcome, Professor Shaw.
Yeah, thanks for having me along. Good to talk to you, Anita.
So let's discuss, why is it so important for GPs to understand CVD risk for patients with type 2 diabetes? Do you have any estimate of how many patients may be actually missing out on appropriate assessment and therefore timely treatment?
I think, unfortunately, this happens too frequently. Many people are aware of the links of diabetes with eye disease, with kidney disease. Not everybody knows about the links to cardiovascular disease, to MIs, to strokes, to peripheral arterial disease. It's often thought of as being something entirely separate, or that's to do with cholesterol or blood pressure or smoking. But it's a major consequence of diabetes and one of the most, if not the most, frequent cause of death among people with diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes. So it really is critical to, on the one hand, recognize that this is an important consequence and complication of diabetes, and on the other hand, recognize that the risk is not the same for everybody, that some people are certainly at very high risk, but others are not at such elevated risk and certainly not at a risk level that needs a pharmacological intervention. And identifying who is and who isn't in that basket is really an absolutely critical part of clinical care.
So the question is, how should CVD risk be assessed in people with type 2 diabetes? And does every type 2 diabetes patient need to have this risk score on file?
There is, as many people will now be aware, an updated Heart Foundation cardiovascular risk calculator, which has really taken us forward from where we have been in previous years. It's used quite a lot of updated data and newer ways of estimating cardiovascular risk, and in particular has a component of the overall calculation that is dedicated to people with diabetes and takes in some extra information about people with diabetes, about their HbA1c, about whether or not they have renal disease, etc. And so it gives us a more nuanced and more accurate assessment of their cardiovascular risk. And for people with diabetes, we should be doing this formally from the age of 35. Not many people at that age will require pharmacological intervention, but some will. And that's the age at which we should start to be recording what that cardiovascular risk estimate is and updating it over time as necessary.
So we know that GPs function in a time-pressured environment. So does this CVD risk have to be calculated only by GPs? Or could a practice nurse or, say, another diabetes allied health practitioner do this assessment for us? And I think you touched upon it. But once it's done, how often should this CVD risk assessment be repeated and reviewed?
So it is actually quite simple to do, and most people will have the information in their medical records that would allow the risk calculator to be done. It doesn't need to be done by a highly skilled general practitioner. It can be done by other allied health professionals. There are some judgments that come into some of it for people who are in intermediate risk levels, and we might come on to those. But it can be straightforward to be done by other people, simply entering things like the blood pressure and the age of the patient, how long they've had diabetes, what their recent HbA1c was. And it's all done online. I think that this now exists in some GP clinical software that might allow you to do it. But it's a very easy thing to do. And it gives a very nice sort of visual presentation of the risk in a way that I think many people can easily understand. So it isn't something that has to be done just in that precious moments that the GP has with the patient, where you can devote that more to interpreting the finding and what you're going to do about it. And I think that's where you want to devote your time.
And it's true, because nurses do a lot of this work anyway when they're doing assessments. They're entering height, weight, they're entering, you know, their lipid profile and other parameters. So you're right, the background work could definitely be done by our nurses and save us time to focus on the clinical considerations. If for intermediate and low-risk patients, like, we don't just do it once and then set and forget,
we need to review it. And so what would be the appropriate intervals of reviewing these patients where we want to just revisit and maybe need to reclassify them with passage of time?
Yes, typically, I mean, this ought to be individualized and certainly should be rethought of if something critical changes. But typically for intermediate risk people, we're talking about reviewing that every couple of years, and for low risk people, probably every 5 years.
So what are the key outputs of this CVD risk calculator, and how do you define high risk?
So as we've done for many years, they're based on the percentage risk that an event, a cardiovascular event, will happen over the next period of time. This is 5 years' time that this one in particular looks at. And so you get a percentage risk, meaning that if there were 100 people like this individual, this percent of them would have an event over the next 5 years. Less than 5% is deemed to be low risk, 5 to 10% is intermediate risk, and 10% and above is high risk. But one of the nice things, I think, about this is that it does allow us to incorporate some of the risk factors for which we don't have accurate enough data to really put numbers in, but we know are important. And these are the sort of risk modifiers. And this is where clinical judgment starts to come into this as to whether or not we should allow those to make a difference. So conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, for example, we know that that family of inflammatory conditions increases cardiovascular risk. We don't have the data to say by exactly how much. And so this risk calculator invites the treating doctor to consider that kind of risk modifier and wonder whether or not it might be enough to change somebody's 9% intermediate risk to 10% plus as high risk.
Now, could you give us some tips on how can we communicate the risk score to patients more effectively so that they recognize the importance of self-management and become more engaged? Because sometimes when we talk about percentages, it does not mean a lot to them. How do we make it a lot more meaningful to those patients?
Yeah, I think this is often a tricky thing. Understanding risk is challenging for healthcare professionals, and it's even more challenging for the general public. Again, the website that this is on does have some nice tools. You know, there are sort of images of 100 people and how many people would have an event over a period of time sort of illustrated, which is effectively just a picture of the percentage. I mean, I think one of the other things that people will often say is, well, how do I compare to everyone else? And it is quite interesting. We do have this focus on absolute risk, but I think that many people in reality think about relative risk. If I'm worse than everybody else, then, I'm prepared to do something about it. I think that the other thing that is worth talking about here is this idea as to whether or not it's worth doing something about it. And many of the interventions that we have are fairly low risk in terms of adverse events. And the other thing that I will often talk to people about is the major role that age plays in this. And if you think you're a bit borderline today, within 5 years, you won't be. So we're having this conversation now. It's only going to get more in favor of you being treated over the next coming years. So some people would see that as meaning, well, okay, then if it's inevitable, let's get started now. Of course, we all know that there are other people who want to remain off treatment as long as possible. And again, there, this is very much a judgment from the treating doctor. And for me, this is where the absolute value of the risk rather than the risk category comes into consideration. So if somebody is 10.1% and so they're just into the high risk, you might treat that differently to somebody who is 15%. And so you should, because their risk is different, even though they actually sit within the same category. So all of those things are relevant in my discussions with people with diabetes.
Right. So Anna, for many years now, we've been told as GPs to think beyond glycemia when we're managing type 2 diabetes patients and focus on implementing a comprehensive cardiorenal metabolic protective strategy for our patients, especially when we're choosing drugs. Could you just elaborate a bit on what are the guideline recommended, treatment sort of options for reducing cardiovascular risk in our type 2 diabetes patients? And once we've determined the CVD risk score, how do we then make these treatment decisions?
Anita, I think this is a really critical point. And, you know, I think this goes back to the earliest things that we do with people with diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes. And so many people, as we know, believe that this is simply a sugar disease. You know, the only abnormality in the system is high blood sugar, they imagine, and they believe that it's caused by eating too much sugar. And so these considerations of this broader risk profile and the idea that diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, is a much more complex condition than simply elevated blood glucose, goes all the way back to there. And so this is relevant to dietary advice, it's relevant to physical activity advice, and of course, as you were saying, is relevant for pharmacological decisions. And so quite often, the best things that we can do to improve cardiovascular risk in people with diabetes is to advise them to stop smoking, is to get their lipids under control with a statin, and of course recognizing that statin therapy is for people who are at high risk, not necessarily just for people with high cholesterol or high LDL. Blood pressure control. And of course now we have glucose-lowering agents that, in addition to their benefits on glucose, have potent benefits for cardiovascular and renal outcomes. So all of those things come into consideration when we're thinking about the overall risk of a person with diabetes.
Yeah, so it's important not just to lower glucose, but how you lower it with the right choice of drug, which that is go beyond glycemia, perhaps is very important when we're making that decision. And what evidence is there to support the addition of these drugs, in particular, say SGLT2 inhibitors, in patients with type 2 diabetes and high cardiovascular risk?
Well, we now have a series of large multinational cardiovascular outcome trials that show beyond a shadow of a doubt that SGLT2 inhibitors and also GLP-1 receptor agonists have marked cardiovascular benefits. The history of this goes back now about 7 or 8 years with the EMPA-REG trial, which showed for empagliflozin, which was the first of the SGLT2 inhibitors to collect this kind of information, a marked reduction in cardiovascular and in renal outcomes, and that was MACE, which is MI and stroke, and even more so for heart failure, and then also for renal disease, that people with type 2 diabetes, and in that particular trial, it was restricted to people with type 2 diabetes and established cardiovascular disease, that putting them on an SGLT2 inhibitor compared to placebo had these marked benefits. And it was very clearly not a consequence of glucose lowering. We still don't really know what the mechanism is that links these agents to cardiovascular and renal benefits, but it isn't glucose lowering, but it's definitely there.
I guess the arrival of this class of medications, SGLT2 inhibitors, was indeed a game changer. So perhaps when we're reaching out for the next drug after metformin, I think we should think about, is this patient at risk of CVD or has already got established cardiovascular disease? And, you know, then consider using a drug like an SGLT2 inhibitor in preference to drugs that are neutral in terms of cardiovascular and renal protection. Would that be fair to say?
It would. In fact, I'd go a little bit further than that, Anita, in that I think that you started that, as we have all been trained to do and continue to do, that the decisions over glucose-lowering drugs are things that are triggered by elevated HbA1c. And of course, for some people, that might be above 6.5, for some above 7, and for others, it might be above 7.5 or even 8, depending on their personal circumstances. But really, before we think about that, we should be thinking about how are we managing their risk. Is this person at elevated cardiovascular or renal risk? And if they are, then we should be looking at their list of medications to see whether or not they have included in that an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist. Because if they are at high cardiovascular risk, one of those agents needs to be part of what we are including, as well as statins, blood pressure lowerings, usually ACE inhibitors or ARBs.
Now, it can be very challenging to keep up with the changes in the PBS constantly. So what were the key changes that were made to some of the subsidized medications for the treatment of type 2 diabetes in June 2024?
The big change that we had was in some ways a simplification. We used to have, you know, several different codes depending on exactly what circumstances, what you were adding it to for an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And so that has now been simplified for each of those classes. We've also seen a slight change in that the SGLT2 inhibitor class, at least from the PBS perspective, has been prioritized as the first choice for people among the SGLT2 inhibitor and GLP-1 receptor agonists. So the GLP-1 receptor agonists are now, from a PBS perspective, are only for those people with type 2 diabetes who are either intolerant to an SGLT2 inhibitor or for whom it is clearly contraindicated. And I guess the simplification is that it's an SGLT2 inhibitor is the first thing that one needs to think of. And certainly for those people who have increased cardiovascular risk and increased renal risk, this is definitely the place to start.
So I guess a clear message has definitely come through today that in a lot of our patients with type 2 diabetes, even though we may be reaching glycemic targets, that's not our only goal, and we should be thinking beyond that, because some of them are not benefiting from therapies that do provide additional cardiorenal benefits. Thank you for taking us through so comprehensively on the assessment of cardiovascular risk in patients with type 2 diabetes. Could you summarize the key messages for our GPs to take from our discussion today?
I think what we all need to bear in mind as GPs, as healthcare professionals, and you know, people with diabetes, that the real challenge, certainly of type 2 diabetes, is its complications. And that's predominantly cardiovascular disease and renal disease. Of course, retinopathy is important, and some of the other neurological and peripheral arterial complications. We need to be aware of the risk status of our patients. We need to update that on a regular basis. We now have very nice tools that we can use that give us these risk estimates. And those people who are at elevated cardiovascular risk need to have interventions, and that's lifestyle, diet and exercise, as well as pharmacological interventions that are directly targeting those risks and for which there is clear evidence of benefit. And that, of course, is the traditional statins, antihypertensives, ACE and ARBs. But now we have glucose-lowering agents in addition to this that have profound cardiovascular and renal benefits, and those need to be top of mind in people who have type 2 diabetes and increased cardiorenal risk.
Thank you, Professor Shaw, for that great, great explanation.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Anita.
Before prescribing the treatments discussed, please review the full product information. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with Boehringer Ingelheim and Eli Lilly, and produced in February 2025. Thank you for listening. We look forward to your company on the next edition of Drive Time GP. Please note that the information provided in these interviews is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Always review product information before prescribing. The views expressed are those of the individual speakers and may not represent those of the supporting organisation or Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.